All right, we're going to look at the book of Job. You may know that we're planning to do this for the next 6 weeks or so. I think we have 1 week break during Mother's Day on May 13th. Otherwise, we'll be going through chapter 1, then 3 through 5, then 29 through 31, then finally 38 through 41, and the last one will be 42. We don't want to go through the whole book because there's a lot of conversations that go back and forth, but we wanted you to get the gist of the book and the essence of the issues and themes involved. And the reason we do it, there's plain and simple. We just want, in the same way we want you to be prepared for any kind of disaster out there, we want you to also be theologically and spiritually prepared for when you have an onslaught of difficulty in your life, tragedy, catastrophe, disease, death in the family, demotions, loss of money, loss of home, going through a divorce, whatever. There's so many things. There's so many ways that life brings injury and sadness to us. And instead of just going through it like, oh no, what's going on? We'd like you to have a strong theological grasp from this book that will end up encouraging you and preparing you so that when those days come, you'll say, okay, first of all, I'm not surprised because I saw it. We talked about this in the book of Job. And secondly, I know how to respond now when that day comes. I wish we could just say that in this church, as long as you come to Gateway, you won't have trials. But you know what? We are not a heresy here. There are churches that say that. You come here, practice your faith, you're going to be rich and healthy. Never. Not a Gateway. Right, Sylvia? You know all too well that that is a charade. It just doesn't happen. Even the most godly people suffer, and that's including all of us. So we'd rather you tell you the truth and tell it to you in love and prepare you for that day when it does happen, and then you will be like Job. You'll have a wonderful opportunity to glorify God in your suffering and trust. Okay, so first of all, I want to, Donna, can you play the first chapter in the audio? This is a beautiful, beautiful dramatized version of Job chapter 1. If you want to follow it in your NIV.
In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking,
"Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts."
This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan,
"Where have you come from?"
Satan answered the Lord,
"From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it."
Then the Lord said to Satan,
"Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil."
"Does Job fear God for nothing?"
Satan replied.
"Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face."
The Lord said to Satan,
"Very well then. Everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger."
Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said,
"The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you."
While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said,
"The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you."
While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said,
"The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you."
While he was still speaking, Yet another messenger came and said,
Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you.
At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said,
Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised.
In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing.
By the way, I recommend before you come here on Sunday, next Sunday and the next Sunday and so forth, is you read or listen to this audio Bible in the very passages that we're going to preach on, and that way you'll get even more from it. Isn't that beautiful? Beautifully done, I thought, with the actor. Each person in the narrative has a special actor, and so I really appreciate that. All right, I've got 5 points in this sermon. The first one is Job's character and public reputation. The text says that there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that this man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. This phrase has 4 different words in it, right? Or 4 different phrases. It's a perfect description of Job's righteous standing before God. The first word is tam. In Hebrew, it means blameless or complete. And interestingly, you might remember, Karen, it's the same word in Turkish, tam. Tam bir Türk gibi konuşuyorsun. They would say, you speak just like a Turk. Or they would say tamam, which means okay, everything's okay. And of course, the verb tamamlamak means to complete something. He was a completed, blameless person in God's sight. Yashar, that's the word for upright or just, walking your life straight, on the straight and narrow. Yare is a verb in Hebrew that means to fear, and it's used throughout the Old Testament, and here it refers to revering God or fearing God. And last of all, the word sur means to turn away from evil. He turned away. He saw evil, and he would just avoid it at all costs. That is a description of what God refers to as the greatest man on earth. Matthew Henry defines it this way: the fear of God reigned in Job's heart, and it was the principle that governed the whole conversation. This made him perfect and upright, inward and entire for God, universal and uniform in religion. This kept him close and constant to his duty. He feared God. He had reverence for his majesty. He had a regard to his authority and a dread of his wrath. He dreaded the thought of doing what was wrong. With the utmost abhorrence and detestation, and with constant care and watchfulness, he eschewed evil, avoided all appearances of sin and approaches to it. I guess we could say from Psalm 15, this is a good description of what Job would have been like. Psalm 15 says, Lord, who shall sojourn or who shall travel in your tent and who will dwell on your holy hill? It's he who walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks truth in his heart and who does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, and in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt, which means that once he says something, he'll keep his promise, no matter even if it's painful for him. He does not change, and he does not put out his money at interest, and does not take a bribe against the innocent. He doesn't try to take advantage financially of people. He who does these things shall never be moved. So that is the description of Job. And John MacArthur gives us a kind of a biographical sketch of Job, so, just so you get him in the context of the history. Remember, the book of Job was probably the oldest book ever written in the Bible. It probably predates the book of Genesis, not in terms of when it happened, but in terms of who wrote it. And Job was not Jewish, okay? He was an Arab. And he lived approximately at the time of Abraham. If you look at the age that I think he died at 140 or 160 years old, or he lived another 140 years, it says. So he must have died before he was 200 or right around 200. And at that time, that's what the typical age of the patriarchs were. So this predates Moses by a long shot, and it's right around the time of Abraham. But he's not part of Abraham's family. However, he lives just about 500 miles to the east of Abraham, in the area of Arabia. And you can see there's about 3 or 4 different places. There's a tomb of Job in Pakistan. There's a tomb of Job in Oman, right on the tip of the Arabic Peninsula. So this is what MacArthur says. The biographical sketch of Job is that he was spiritually mature. He was a father of many children. He owned many herds. He was wealthy and influential. He was a priest to his family. He was a loving and wise husband. And he was a man of prominence in community affairs. He was a man of benevolence. He was a wise leader. He was a grower of crops. Matthew Henry tells us that the account of Job's piety and prosperity comes before the history of his great afflictions to show that neither will secure us from the calamities of human life. It doesn't matter how spiritual you are, none of us will escape calamity. It doesn't matter how rich you are, I don't care how much insurance you buy, that cannot protect you from calamity. If God wills it, it's going to happen. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. So I reckon, I've been with a shepherd. I know that Hassan, my friend, had the maximum number of sheep he had was 160 sheep, but he had to hire a shepherd to help him. And I would help him when he had about 120. So I'm thinking that probably one shepherd would have to, the ratio of a shepherd to a sheep was about 50 or 60 sheep to one shepherd. And the same with the other animals, even like maybe 30 cattle to one shepherd, things like that. So if that's the case, I did the math, and I came up with he probably had a minimum of 70 sheep herders, 100 camel herders, 250 cattle hands, 15 donkey herdsmen, and at least 200 servants, meaning he had somewhere between 635 and 1,000 personnel that were working in his empire. Because he had he couldn't go take care of these animals by himself, but he would pay his shepherds. He had servants to make sure everyone got paid their amount, and then they had their big town where they lived, and everyone had their tents or their homes or whatever, homes, because his children had homes. So he was the greatest of all those people. In fact, from Job 29, it describes his public role in society. So you get a picture of what it was like for him to walk into a room. He said, when I went out to the gate of the city, which is where all the elders meet, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and they withdrew, and the aged rose and stood. Now, I know enough about Kurdish culture when I was there in Diyarbakir that when I sat in a tea house and an older man came, like my friend was talking with me and his father walked in, we both stood up. And immediately he would take a cigarette, put it out, because his father walked in. And you always show respect to the aged. And so the interesting thing about Job is that he was a man who was in his 40s and 50s, and people treated him higher than they would have treated someone in their 80s, because he had gained such influential status. He was such a powerful man, so well respected, that they granted him the kind of favor that you normally give to your seniors. The young men saw me and they withdrew. The aged rose and they stood. The princes refrained from talking and they laid their hand on their mouth. And when the ear heard, it called me blessed. When the eye saw, it approved, because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me. He probably had a section there for like a convalescent home. You know, he took care of the aged people that couldn't walk anymore, and he made sure they had food and clothing. The blessing of him who was about to perish came, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. If you were a widow, and you happen to be coming through his country, his servant said, not one widow could ever lay a charge that did not eat meat from Job's table and get a coat made from the fleece of his sheep. They were so well cared for. I put on righteousness and it clothed me. And my justice was like a robe and a turban. People respected this man because there was no one like him. And even God says it to Satan, I have no one like him. So let's look at his role as a father. Number two, his sons used to go and hold a feast. Remember, there were 7 boys and 3 girls. And they would hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. And they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So obviously, there was a lot of beautiful love, filial love between these siblings. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. So this is very interesting. For those of you who are parents, like Eli and Terry and Debbie and myself, and you know, a lot of people here have grown kids, right? And these are now, if he's in his, let's say, early 50s at this point, and his children are all in their 20s, and some of them are married, some of them are not yet married, he's thinking, you know what? I know my sons and I know my daughters, and I know it's possible that they don't have the same faith that I have. And so, Lord, I pray that you would please forgive them, be patient with them. Please help them change. How many of you have not uttered that prayer, David Rodriguez? How many of us, right? How many of us have had children in which none of them have been a prodigal? I don't see any hands going up. Gloria, you brought distress on that woman there, the one you're sitting next to, right? Oh my goodness, if anyone can say, I know what it's like to be a mother of a prodigal. Oh, but we won't go into details. We're just happy you're here doing so well. So he was aware of the fact that his children might be sinning, and he was making, in his prayers, he was actually making up for that and saying, please, Lord, I offer this offering for the sake of this son, for the sake of this daughter, because I don't know what's going on in their heart. I don't know if they're all there yet spiritually, but I want them to know you like I know you. In fact, he illustrates this passage that we read from Moses to the Israelites, that he tells them, you know, when they were in the wilderness, they were kind of simple, right? They had their clothing and they had their sandals and they didn't wear out. And they were waiting for that day that they came into the land of Canaan. And then Moses makes this really interesting warning, because he says, you know, the day's going to come where you go into the land of Canaan and you're going to be rich and you're going to have everything you need, and you're going to have flocks and herds, and you're going to have vineyards, and then you're going to have... you know, you'll have all the olive trees, and you'll have everything that a person could possibly want. It's the land of milk and honey. So this is what he says. Take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and statutes, which I command you today, lest when you have eaten and you're full and you have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, and you're driving a Mercedes, and you're living in South Pasadena, and your kids go to a private school, and you got the greatest insurance policy, and your 401k is in the millions, be careful. Because your heart might be lifted up, and you will forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's where you were. Don't forget it. You were once a slave. You had to make your own bricks. Day by day, you were mistreated. Matthew Henry said, still, Job was the priest of the family, and at his altar, they all attended, valuing their share, the children valuing their share in his prayers more than the share in his estate. So all the men who are here who are fathers, you know, it says in the New Testament that every Christian is a priest. However, the priestly role of praying for the family falls on you, Eli, on you, Mario, on me, Christopher, on you, Alejandro, on you, Ernie. It doesn't stop when you're a grandpa, right? He took it upon himself to pray and offer these offerings early in the morning, and I guess that that's a good time for us to think about praying for our family too. When we're alone with God and we bring them up one by one. God, I want to pray for this daughter. In my case, this daughter, I have four daughters and three sons-in-law. And now I have five grandchildren, five grandsons. So I got lots of people to pray for if I'm going to be like Job. Job was not only so rich and great, but withal so wise and good. And he had such interest both in heaven and earth, Matthew Henry says, that one would think the mountain of his prosperity stood so strong that it could not be moved. But here we have a thick cloud gathering over his head, pregnant with a horrible tempest, right? A storm. We must never think ourselves secure from storms while we are in this lower region of the earth. Never. Don't forget, storms happen to the best of us. And so we see, number three, a rare window into heaven's mystery. This kind of a paragraph, you don't see a lot in the Old Testament, right? Where suddenly God is gathering his angels together, and you see the fallen angels and the good angels, and they're all in conversation. Oh my goodness, this is a very privileged, we are a privileged people to be able to read this part of it, because Job did not know this happened. He was not privy to this conversation that was happening between God and Satan. Only we, the readers, now can read what happened up there. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was also among them. And the Lord decides What? He's going to boast about Job to Satan. And I'll tell you why. Because God takes more delight in the sons of men than he does in all of creation. Watch this. I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but I just want to read to you a passage in the New Testament. Where is it? Well, I'll get to it later. I'll read it to you. I don't want to lose track of where I'm at here. But anyway, let me read on, and we'll see how it is that God takes pride in those saints that belong to him. So the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? And Satan answered and said, well, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And we know from Peter that Satan is like a lion, a roaring lion that is going to and fro seeking someone whom he can devour. That's why he's going around the earth. Who can I take? Who can be my victim today? And the Lord said to him, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And then Satan said, well, does Job fear God for no reason? He questions his faith. Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all he has on every side? You know what that tells us? That tells us that the MO of heaven is to bless his people. The normal way that a Christian experiences life is for God to bless me on this side, in front of me and behind me and to my right and to my left, because God loves his children and he loves to bless them. And when you live a life that is a straight and narrow path, you're going to be blessed. You're going to end up saving more money because you're not, you'll learn to be frugal and to have discipline and to think about the future and the plan for your estate and so forth. You're going to have a happier marriage. You're going to have better food. You're going to take care of your health better. There's all kinds of blessings that happens to the saints because God puts a hedge around them. Once they belong to him, he said, that's the hedge. I've got this hedge around him and nobody can touch him. Jesus said, no one can pluck you out of his hand. He's greater than all. So now, Satan accuses him, saying, well, I'll tell you what, God, if you took away that hedge, if you opened it just a smite and let me in and let me attack him, then you'd find out he's really mercenary. He's only paid to be good. He wouldn't be that way unless you had built this hedge. If you take that hedge away, gone will be his faith. You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But you stretch out your hand and you touch all he has, surely he will curse you. He'll give up. And you won't have a man left on earth who believes in you. It's all a sham. Matthew Henry says, it is likely that Satan did think that Job, if impoverished, would renounce his religion and so disprove his profession of faith. And if so, would have made out his own universal empire among the children of men. Get this, I never thought about it until I read these comments. God declared Job the best man then living. Okay? That means that if Satan can prove Job to be a hypocrite, it will follow that God had not one faithful servant among men. And that there was no such thing as true and sincere piety in the world. But religion was all a sham. And Satan was king de facto. De facto means in fact. Okay, here's the official king, Yahweh God. But the real king whom people obey is Satan over all of mankind. The stakes could not be higher. Think about that. Because once God said, this is the best man I have, and if Satan could prove that he wasn't a real follower of God, that he only did it because God would bribe him to it, Satan won the whole game. It appeared that the Lord, however, knows those who are his, and he is not deceived in any way. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, everything he has is in your hand. Think about that. You can take every single thing he has to test us, and we'll see who's true, you or me. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So he put the limit there, right? So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And this time he wasn't going to and fro, he was going right to one man and putting all his demons in charge. Okay, I could just see him having a meeting saying, okay, when we get this man, we're going to get him 1, 2, 3, 4, like that. I mean, I want it within minutes. I want you, the first one to come in there, tell him the news, and then right after that, before he finishes his sentence, the next servant is going to come in and give him the next one, and we're going to wear him down until the point was he'll curse God. You just watch. Matthew Henry says, it is a matter of wonder that God should give Satan such a permission as this, that God should deliver the soul of his turtle dove into the hand of the adversary. Because he said, he's in your hand. That God would give up such a beautiful lamb to such a ferocious lion. But he did it for his own glory. He did it for the honor of Job. He did it to explain providence and how it works. He did it as an encouragement for all his afflicted people in all ages to make a case which, being adjudged, he might be a useful precedent for everyone. That's why I think the book of Job is the first book in the Bible. It's the oldest book. And the reason he wasn't Jewish is to illustrate the fact that suffering comes on every single ethnicity, not just God's chosen people in the Old Testament. It's for everybody. The book of Job is a universal book for everyone. Okay, now let me show you Ephesians 3. This is what I was going to read before. Watch what God does and how God, this mystery that takes place in heaven of how heaven looks at what's going down on earth, and we sometimes forget how important things are to God that seemingly are for us not so important, right? It says that Ephesians 3 shows that God has chosen to display his glory through the saints. Paul says this, to me this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ. And then he says this amazing thing, and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God. Nobody understood this. But it's this mystery hidden in the ages for ages in God who created all things so that through the church, the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. So get this. God is not only using Job or allowing Job to become the person by which his glory is manifested, and he's doing it in front of all the angels, including the fallen ones. He's doing the same thing to the church. He's using the church, that is you and me, Lupe. The church is not this building. It is the people who are here. We are the ecclesia. We are the church. And he's using the church. He says, through the church, the beauty of God and the glory of God will be seen to all the angels. He's interested in showing Satan and his demons the same truth that he showed with Job, that true faith cannot be destroyed because I am God. And they know it. And I did a life transformation of these people, and I live inside them. My spirit is there, and you cannot take them out of my hand. I don't care what you do to test them. And I believe that Satan continues this conversation over and over and over again. That happened to this dear woman over here in her 90s, that when she was in her 40s, her husband left her. And I said, Mom, do you see the conversation going on there? Satan said, sure, Lois is so special to you, but you do that. You let her go through a divorce and she will give up the faith. You watch. All right, do it. She's 92 and she's been in church every week of her life and she has never given up the faith. And it was after the divorce, after my father left, that we came to Christ one by one. That's when she took my hand at age 13 and said, we're going to this church. And I heard the gospel. And it was about 50 years ago. I'm 63 now. When I was 13, that I gave my life to Christ because God allowed that terrible thing to happen to our family and to her. He could not shake her faith out of her. And it was so real that every one of the five children came to faith in the next 10 years after that event. I'm the third of five kids. The chain. Matthew Henry said, it is a matter of comfort that God has the devil in a chain, in a great chain. Revelation 20 says, then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and shut it and sealed it over him so that he might not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were ended. And after that, he must be released for a while and so forth and so on. So in other words, Satan is God, or the devil is God's devil, right? God has absolute power over him. Thank you. I was just thinking, I need some tissue. This is a wonderful man, Mario Guerra. I said, Mario, you made coffee this morning. Do you want someone else to make coffee like you do it once a month? He goes, no, I'll do it every week. Now, isn't that a servant? Except for the 29th of this month. I need someone to take his spot on the last Sunday. So if you're ready to do that, let me know. Okay, number four, the unfolding of Job's trial. Now, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. Matthew Henry pointed out that the oldest brother had a double inheritance, so the food was really good here, right? The house was really big. It was bigger than all the other houses because that was the firstborn son. And they were in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing, and so forth, you know, the donkeys were feeding, and the Sabians attacked, and so forth, took off with them. And the next one, I mean, no, he continues, he said, took them and struck the servants with the edge of the sword, and alone have escaped to tell you, I alone. Then the next servant says, he was still speaking, and then came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And this part, the second part of the sheep, is particularly sad. The devil, Matthew Henry says, aiming to make him curse God and renounce his religion, managed this part of the trial very artfully, very skillfully, in order thereto, number one, his sheep, which he used to honor God in sacrifice, they were all taken from him, as if God were angry at his offerings and would punish him in those very things which he had employed in his service. So this is very interesting. Having misrepresented Job to God as a false servant, right, in the beginning, in pursuance of his old design to see heaven and earth at variance, like he wants to put a split between us, he here misrepresented God to Job as a hard master who would not protect his flocks out of which he had so many burnt offerings. This would tempt Job to say, it is vain to serve God. So Satan is desperately trying to give you a false image of God and to give God a false image of us. He's doing the exact opposite of what a priest does. He wants to divide us, and the priest wants to unite people by representing them in prayer to intercession to God and by giving an accurate description or revelation from God to the person. Number two, the messenger called the lightning the fire of God. Well, that was innocent enough. But perhaps Satan, Matthew Henry says, thereby designed to strike into his mind the thought that God had turned to be his enemy and fought against him, which was much more grievous to him than all the insults of the Sabians. How terrible, then, were the tidings of this destruction, which came immediately from the hands of God, quote unquote. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans, they formed three groups, and they made off with the camels, and they struck down the servants. While he was yet speaking, there came the last, right? And Satan purposely waited till the fourth one to give him the news, your children have died. Your sons and daughters, they were eating and drinking wine, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners, and they fell down, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped. So one thing we can note right here, boom, 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 four in a row. You know, the Psalm 42 says, deep calls to deep, and at the roar of your waterfalls, all your breakers and your waves have gone over me. Why does the psalmist describe trials in terms of waves? It's because they happen one after another. They often happen together. This is not unusual to have all these things in your life come to naught at one time or within a short period. Because you feel like, oh gosh, what's happening? What did I do? I'm losing money over here. Then someone else, their health is gone. And then something terrible happened here. And you're trying to figure out how that could all happen at once. Why didn't God divide them up and give you just one per year or one for every 6 months? And then you can handle it better. Trials often come in waves, just the way it is. For Karen and me, when we came back, we were wanting to spend time with our daughters, and everything happened at once. We got off the plane, and I started limping. It was August 2008, and the recession just hit rock bottom. And all we could do was get her, she got one interview to get one job with a modest wage, and I couldn't find employment, and then I had to have my amputation, and then my daughters couldn't find employment. Three out of six of our adult family members were out of work. And so what do we have to do? We had to live together and share the rent and try to make out somehow and get by. And I remember one time someone sent me an $800 check to help us get by, and other people helped me financially, and it was a hard time. Everything happened at once, or seemingly in waves like that. In fact, what's really sad about this one, think about this. His three friends, as you'll see later on in the book of Job, when they heard that his sons and daughters were killed in that accident, Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "Now, Job, God doesn't pervert justice, does he? Does the Almighty pervert the right? No. If your children have sinned against him, then he's delivered them into the hand of their transgression." Oh my goodness. That would cut deep. They made the conclusion that since God allowed them to die, they must have all been sinning against him. Boy, Job, you didn't have very nice kids in heaven's sight, because look, they were all killed. But if you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, Job, in your heart, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. This is pure prosperity gospel, right? If something happens to you where you lose your health or you lose lives in your family or something, well, if Satan's attacking, then where's your lack of it? What happened? Let's go find out. Like Charles Craft would say, we got to find the demon that came in there and what you did to allow that demon to bring you cancer. Because otherwise you wouldn't have this, because God doesn't want you to have cancer. Oh my goodness. What do you do with the book of Job? Charles Craft, you sound just like Bildad. You and those in the prosperity gospel are just like the three friends who said, there's got to be something you did wrong to result in this kind of a bad thing in your life. Some mistake you made, some wounded spirit, some bitterness, something you're hiding from us. Come on, fess up. That's what they were saying. And they said, what are you talking about? Why do you guys talk to me this way? I have spent my life serving the poor. I've never been this kind of person you're assaulting me to be or accusing me to be. Oh, no, but look what happened, Job. I mean, God wouldn't do this unless he was displeased with you. Come on. And your kids dying? All right, Fessa, what were they doing? Maybe you didn't keep track of them well enough. Job's humble faith. 5. Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return." Now, this is most interesting. When you have a trial in your life, you can think logically or you can think entitlement. There was no entitlement mentality in him, not one. He just simply said, wait a minute. God just took everything away, but I'm actually today no different than I was when I was born. God has not done anything wrong against me. In fact, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. So blessed be the name of the Lord. He can do whatever he wants to with my life. I'm just as naked as I was when I was born. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And you can see at this point, all of hell was screaming. Like, no, you're not supposed to say that. The wrong line, Job. And God up there is just smiling, smirking. Oh, 1-0. Heaven 1, hell 0. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. It's the same kind of humble faith that Paul and Silas had. Paul and Silas, they were there in Philippi preaching the gospel, and people got angry with them, so they said, "These men are Jews, and they're disturbing our city. They have advocated customs that are not lawful." So the crowd joined in attacking them, and the magistrate tore their garments. They gave orders to beat them with rods, and when they had inflicted many blows on them, they threw Paul and Silas into prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. And having received this order, he put them into the inner prison. And there, he fastened their feet in the iron stocks. Oh my goodness. Or wood stocks. They couldn't move. So there, they again, in the New Testament, you have someone who was doing the right thing and who was slapped back into place and given the worst treatment of all. And it says about midnight, what happened? Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God. How can you do that, Gloria, unless you're a woman of faith? How can you be in jail and yet read the Bible and teach other women in Bible unless you're a woman of faith? Why is it that you were not bitter at God? You were not operating on entitlement saying, "Lord, I don't deserve this," or, "Hey, get me out of here quickly. We prayed for you. You didn't get out right away when we wanted you to, right? It took longer. How many months were you there?" Well, we won't go into detail. But anyway, while she was there, she, like Paul and Silas, learned to praise God and find these women who had need, and she led them in a Bible study, what, day after day, I guess, huh? That's the same thing that happened to me when I was in jail. They allowed me my Bible, and so we ended up with Bible. I taught a Bible study to the guys in my cell. And here in Paul and Silas, and what happens, this is so fascinating. They're praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them, and suddenly there was a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison were shaken, and immediately all the doors were open and everyone's bonds was unfastened. That's incredible. It was as if God wanted to give his answer and to say, I am well pleased with someone who in the midst of prison will praise me and sing hymns to me. That cuts ice with God. That is something. That's why Job and the story with Job was written. That's why I told my mom, Mom, if you are like your other relatives, the other ladies in your, you know, she has a sister-in-law, she has other people that live their life, they're Christians, they live, they're happy, they've got a nice home, they got a nice savings, and they're now in their, you know, older years, and they're just happy. But I said, none of their events will be written in a story, but yours, your life is written up. I've already written it as a poem, and one day it's going to be known to people because they hear the story of what you went through, and they immediately identify with you, and it's like God made you a special model citizen for the rest of the people. That's what Job was. He became a model for all of us. And so I want to conclude with Peter's statement here when he says, Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar, not that it's painful, but rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you're insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed because the spirit of glory and God rests on you. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or evildoer or meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. Therefore, and he makes this wonderful conclusion, let those who suffer according to God's will and trust their souls to a faithful creator while doing good. We see that with Nick Vujicic, you know, the guy that has no limbs. Some of you have seen like a video with him. He's got the beautiful Hawaiian wife and two kids now. He has no limbs, right? He was born that way. And you could think that if he was an entitlement person, he'd say, why did you make me this way? Oh, there must not be any God. And become a raging atheist. Or Johnny Erickson Tata. She had this terrible accident at age 16, 17, and boom, cut her spinal cord, and she was completely quadriplegic, you know, or almost all. She was quadriplegic. She couldn't move her arms either. She had to use her mouth to draw art. And then I think of Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking, God gave him a brilliant mind, but gave him this terrible disease. And you know what? He said, then there is no God. Why would he give me this mind and then make me crippled with my, so I can't move my body around? He could have, it would have been the most beautiful story to have this man walking with Christ and saying to the whole world, it doesn't matter what your limitation is, look what God gave me. He gave me a mind and I can explore the mysteries of the galaxies and tell you about it. But no, it's that whole thing of entitlement. Why? How dare my creator treat me this way? And Job was like, oh no, actually he's done nothing wrong. I was born this way. I'm going to die this way. He gives and he takes away. Blessed be his name. Lastly, I just want to say that I identify with Job. When I got my amputation, when I was under chemotherapy, my blood count went from 14.3 or 15 down to 4.5, and I was almost comatose. And our family was in financial straits, and all the ministry that I've ever wanted to do was out the window, and I knew I would never minister again. I'd never be asked to be a pastor again. I'd never have that opportunity. And I had the amputation, and I finished the chemotherapy, and then I found out that my elbow here was getting warm, and it looked like it was growing a tumor there, just like my knee had. Oh, my goodness. I thought, okay, I know the statistics. I already read them all about it. The sarcoma patient, if he has metastasis in his lungs, the average lifespan is 11 months. If it happens over here, they can try to extend my life by amputating my arm. So I began to visualize Sylvia having one right leg and then one left arm, because it was my left leg that was amputated, then it was going to be my right arm. And I thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to live with one arm and one leg? I'm going to look like a monster. But there was one encouragement, that is that there's a chain on Satan. He can only go so far as God says, and after that, no father. And I knew, okay, if God is going to end up taking my life, at least I have a conscience. It doesn't accuse me before my Creator. I know that when I see the Lord, He'll receive me. That was my comfort, Terry. during those times where I thought, I'm not going to make it. God had other plans. Job could never have imagined that he'd get 10 more kids and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and that he would live another 140 years to see them all, and that he'd have double the number of oxen and sheep. And he never dreamed that that could happen. And I told my wife, I don't think I'll live to see my grandchildren. And here I am, 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, no, 4 years ago, my daughter Bethany said, Daddy, we're expecting. And I thought, I'm still alive. I'm still here. I'm going to see my grandchild. And to make it almost a special blessing, God knows how much I suffered as the only man around 5 women in my life. So he gave me a grandson. And then Emily said, 3 months later, Dad, guess what? I'm expecting. Oh my goodness, a second grandchild. He came out a boy. I'm thinking, hey, the scales are beginning to finally come back. And then Janelle said, wait for me, I'm getting married next year. And she was hoping for a honeymoon baby. And sure enough, 11 months after their wedding, she gave birth to a boy. 3 grandsons. And the other two said, well, we're expecting our next two. And they came out with 2 more boys. That's 5 grandsons. Within 21 months, I became a grandfather. And I feel like I'm the richest man in California. Even Bill Gates can't boast of that. And Billy and I are the same exact age. We were born the same within a few months of each other. He's 63 years old, and he has 2 teenage kids and 1 in his 20s, and he's going to have to wait until he's in the convalescent home to see a grandchild. And here I am, Bill Gates. I'm already 5 times over, and a few weeks ago, Bethany said, we're on our 6th now, Dad. It's coming. And Karen was going to pray that it would be a girl, and then she realized, I'm late. I'm too late. It's already formed. So I said, nanny, 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 it's my turn now. I'm getting all my little sons. I could have never dreamed, David Rodriguez, that I'd be in this position. Never in a million years. I feel so rich. I go there, and it is chaos. I love this chaos. These boys running around picking up Easter eggs and, opa, opa, you know, showing me their stuff. And oh, man, God is faithful. Let's pray that God will help us when we are called to suffer, to realize the truth of Job 1. Father, I do thank you for the beauty.